Hello and welcome to the Sheldrake Vernon dialogue with myself, Mark Vernon, and Rupert Sheldrake. Hi, Rupert.
Hello, Mark.
Rupert, we get together and have a conversation about what we've been reading about, thinking about recently, and have these conversations quite freeform and open-ended to see what comes up for us, and very much hoping that listeners too will have their own thoughts and their imagination will be running as they're listening as well, to open up the conversation more broadly. And in that spirit, I was thinking this morning about two books that I've been reading and a third book that is coming out. And they all seem to fall into the same domain. And it's this domain of what's sometimes called big history. It's the attempt to try and tell a kind of big story of humanity and the world and even the cosmos, to give us a sense of place and even meaning. And so I wanted about talking about that because I find it very interesting of what's going on in this attempt to find a new meaning story.
Mm.
So the book that I know that's coming out, and this is the other reason I'm interested in it, is because my own book, A Secret History of Christianity, Jesus, the Last Inkling and the Evolution of Consciousness, is coming out at the end of August 2019. And so this is something that I've been watching in the zeitgeist a bit, and I try and tell one big story, which I'm very happy to go over. But they contrast, that story that I'm trying to tell does contrast in very distinctive ways to what you might call more secular or overtly atheistic stories which are around. I mean, we've talked about Noah Yuval Harari's Sapiens and Homo Deus before, which is kind of one story, but I'm thinking about of a couple of others particularly now. And one's by a chap called David Christian. I mean, it's called Origin Story, A Big History of Everything. And then another one is called Out of Our Minds, What We Think and How We Came to Think It, and by Felipe Fernanda Amesto. This one by Christian and Fernandez and Amesto are very different from the account which I'm trying to put forward.
Mm.
So I was wondering about teasing that out.
Yes.
And if it was to come down to anything, it's, you know, does the big history, does the biggest story you could possibly tell, does it sort of spring out of nothing, as it were, with that one initial miracle, a big bang, if you like, and then everything unfolds from that, gradually emerging, which is what one side of the story is trying to tell. Or is it the story that I'm trying to tell, which is that there was a kind of primordial deity, one spirit, consciousness, that was so excessive in its being that the cosmos sort of spontaneously flowed out of it, I mean, all its multiple and diverse forms. And then that multiplicity is the zone in which we're living now, and with this yearning to sort of return back to our divine origins in the multiple forms that different cultures and so on produce. So is it, as it were, a cosmos that's replete with meaning, or almost got an overflow of meaning, which in many respects we in the modern world have lost sight of? Or is it ultimately meaningless, but somehow we little isolated flames of consciousness in our brains, you know, conjure meaning out of these big processes. Now, I mean, I could drill more into all that, but just to give you, first thought, I mean, it's kind of interesting at the very least that there's these big stories around at the moment.
Well, it is. I suppose the best known is the one you mentioned, Yuval Noah Harari, his two books, Sapiens and Homo Deus, because he's trying to portray this very big sweep of history, but from an explicitly atheistic point of view. And I suppose that the reason for these people adopting that atheist point of view is because they buy into the standard scientific materialist picture of the universe, which doesn't prove that the universe has no meaning and is just unconscious matter and so on and pointless and purposeless. That's the upfront assumption of that scientific model. So if they're just accepting that model of reality, they're accepting a particular worldview, which is very predominant in our culture because it's the dominant worldview of scientific orthodoxy. Are they all explicit that that's where they're starting from? They're accepting this scientific story as true.
Yes, they are. They're saying that science is building up a new story. I guess what's different is they also, though, feel a sense of crisis. that whereas, you know, maybe 50 years ago, when scientific materialism was still pretty dominant, there wasn't a sense of humanity facing a crisis. So it didn't really matter if there was no meaning round and about, because no one felt that there was the need to find some sense of purpose or direction to conjure up an ethic to combat things like climate change, for example. That now is very pressing. So I think that's the reason, one of the reasons why these news stories are starting to be put together. People are trying to weave them again because they feel we need some sort of backdrop, even if it's ultimately resting on a sort of void or, you know, a kind of meaningless empty space of the cosmos. There is a sort of, there is a sense of we need something again now, both sort of sociologically and I think existentially.
But is the structure of their arguments simply to accept the scientific worldview as true and then to try and explain it and find meaning, or do they actually question this worldview?
No, they're not questioning the worldview. So, for example, David Christian, in his book, the big sort of driver in his story is the idea of emergence, that you can tell the history of the cosmos as a series of thresholds being passed. So there was the Big Bang, which originally was a kind of undifferentiated ball of energy, and then gradually atoms and particles start to appear. And that's the first threshold. Mm. And then from atoms and particles, you gradually get stars forming, and then new elements forming in stars. That's another threshold. Eventually you reach the emergence of life, another threshold. So the idea is that you'd never have anticipated life just from the Big Bang, but nonetheless that's kind of emerged. That's the sort of story he tells. Fernando Ernesto has a different approach. What he finds interesting is that the cosmos seems to be replete, first of all, with information. And the point about information is that it means that it's not just stuff happens, but that information directs the way stuff happens. This is this relatively new part of the science story, actually, the idea that information plays a key part in both physics and biology. Mm. But then he, that in human minds morphs to imagination, which is not just the capacity to follow rules, but is the capacity, if you like, to imagine new rules, to make stuff up. So life, certainly in the human imagination, kind of supercharges the information of the cosmos. But it's still seen as information has no more meaning than just a kind of a development of materialism.
I see. So all this imagination is just inside human brains. Does he think there's any other consciousness in the universe apart from human brains or possibly animal brains?
No, he doesn't, no. I mean, I think he would, you know, grant that he does grant that animals have inner life, have consciousness, but he thinks that the thing that distinguishes us as humans is certainly the abundance of our imaginative powers. Mm. That, you know, we can, as it were, build whole cities having imagined them first, whereas you know, the beaver, you may say the beaver imagines what do beavers live in? It's suddenly slipped my mind.
Lodges,
thank you. Yes, you know, that may have a sort of, as it were, an archetype of the lodge in its mind, but it would never imagine a whole cluster of lodges and then a sort of skyscraper lodge and all the rest of it, which is what we humans can do.
Mm. I see. So they don't take into account other forms of consciousness in the universe or the possibility of them.
Certainly not other Well, maybe not just disembodied, but other consciousnesses that aren't in living things on planet Earth.
Yes. So then, given the fact that the history of humanity until very recently was always shaped by mythologies, religions, belief systems about gods, spirits, ancestors, angels, and so on, they assume that's all just in human minds and hence in human brains.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I wonder whether the weak point, or one of the weak points in this attempt, apart from requiring this sort of primordial miracle that something sprung out of nothing, yeah, which is a pretty big ask, but just putting that to one side, we have talked about that before. I wonder what you think about this, the role of information increasingly, say in biology. I mean, that must be something you've seen emerge over the course of your career, the interest in information.
Yes, I mean, I personally prefer the word form. Information carries with it the baggage of information theory, which is about transmitting bits of information over telephone lines originally. Shannon, who developed it, was a telephone engineer. So it's technologized, and it's technologized in the context of kind of digital technologies. The number of bits of information are what make a difference, so you can specify something compared with something else. I think if we want to demystify this concept, which is very rarely used in its strict technical sense, what people really mean is form. And information is that which puts form into things, in formation. If we use the word form, then I think it becomes much clearer. It's obvious that in the history of the universe, forms have increased. At the moment of the Big Bang, there was no form. It was a kind of homogeneous chaos. As things cooled down, then atoms could appear. And as the universe expanded and cooled further, then stars and galaxies could appear. And finally, when stars exploded and gave rise to heavier elements, which appeared for the first time, then planets could appear, and then life could appear on planets. Now, in this entire process, as the universe expands and cools down, there's an increase in the amount of form. Generally speaking, in science, the hotter the temperature, the less the form. So at the highest temperatures, you have plasmas, where you don't even have atoms. You have the nuclei and the electrons separated. Cool it down, you get it condensed into gas, where you've got atoms or molecules, like carbon dioxide, oxygen, nitrogen, as in our atmosphere, where you've got more complex forms, atoms and molecules. Cool that down further, and you get liquids, which like water, and which don't have a fixed shape but have a surface and so on. Cool that down further and you get crystals, which have a great deal more form and order, and rocks are all made of crystals. So in the universe, starting with no form, as stars don't have rocks and crystals, but as things cool down, you get more and more form. And then as biological evolution occurs, you get more and more form as more species come into being. So I think it's undoubtedly true that there's an increase in the amount of form in the universe. To say it's an increase in the amount of information makes it sound as if what comes first is some kind of abstract scientific concept which gives rise to the form. It's just much plainer and simpler to say there's an increase in form than it's an obvious truth.
Yes, and does that deal with the problem that I also feel comes up with information, is that in order to have an exchange of information, you also need to have the capacity to at least read that information and do something with it, to turn it into some sort of form? Because I felt that certainly in one of the books I've been reading, that's slightly fudged, that because if there's information, then you've got to have the capacity to do something with that information, and that's all got to sort of spring into existence simultaneously. And a bit like the problems around the origin of language, that language is not just single words, but is a whole grammar and structure and a complicated way of communicating that's got to be understood as much as spoken. It feels like quite a big ask for suddenly information to be doing all this work. I wonder, well, you know, buried in there, there's the notion that the cosmos has a kind of intelligence. And then, you know, if it has a kind of intelligence, then is that a sort of consciousness, or at least capacity to do things other than just sort of billiard balls knocking into each other?
Well, I mean, implicit in all this is the kind of crypto-Platonism that science is based on. In the 17th century, it was taken for granted that the whole universe was governed by eternal mathematical laws, ideas in the mind of God. And that, in turn, grew out of a kind of simplified version of the Platonic tradition, the idea that the Platonic realm of forms and ideas underlies all reality. In other words, a realm of pure information, if you like, forms, ideas, that's what they're called in Plato's philosophy. So there's always been the idea that there's this realm of forms and ideas transcending the cosmos. In the scientific terms, this is then turned into this kind of concept of information and increasing information. But in an evolutionary universe, the question of creativity emerges in various forms. Is the appearance of all these new forms of plants and animals and crystals and stuff the working out of information that's already there in a kind of Platonic realm, an eternal realm beyond space and time? or is it made up as it goes along? Is evolution the appearance of new forms, new patterns that weren't already latently possible or stored up in some kind of transcendent realm to start with? I myself think that there's an emergence of new forms, there's a genuine creativity in evolution, which seems to be more or less what they're saying. But there's nothing in that idea that makes one, that commits one to a kind of materialist view that this is coming out of meaninglessly, coming out of nothing, or with no higher form of consciousness. I mean, that's just an assumption that they seem to be making based on materialism.
Yeah, and the other thing is that I think with Plato, originally what's translated as forms or ideas in Plato, what gets lost in that translation is that for Plato, they're clearly living entities. They have a kind of vitality. I actually think it's much more accurate to think of Plato's ideas as angels, really, in the slightly older sense of powers and principalities, kind of active agents within the cosmos that don't just, as it were, replicate stuff that exists elsewhere, but are genuinely creative as well. Hmm. You know, in the Timaeus, one of Plato's dialogues, you get the sense of this great symphony unfolding across the cosmos with all sorts of new tunes and harmonies emerging, which weren't possible before, sort of overseen by the great musician, if you like, but who's more like a conductor than a mechanic,
yes.
Which is how it tends to be imagined now. That sense of sort of vitality and the living quality of the cosmos, you know, I suppose that's another thing that gets lost with the materialist worldview we have now. That's, you know, it's the disenchantment of the cosmos, except for the little flickering bits of enchantment inside our heads.
Yes. So their approach then is to say, yes, there's this increase in what they call information, what I call form, that this is, but this is happening with nothing beyond the cosmos that gives rise to it. It's somehow spontaneously appeared.
Yeah, and it's spontaneously appeared, and also they're all quite pessimistic about the future, because what they don't see is a sort of external source for the generation of, say, new ideas, new information, new thresholds, because the cosmos is viewed as this kind of enclosed system. So, for example, in his book, Fernandez Amesto rather laments what he sees as the homogenization of a global culture, because he felt that ideas are generated by the conflicts between cultures, and that if, as the world becomes more globalized, so there'll be less kind of, certainly ideological conflicts, he argues. I mean, that's a moot point, but nonetheless, he argues. And so there's a kind of running down of the imaginative capacities of humanity. So we'll sort of tend to tail off, a bit like the cooling off of the cosmos with entropy as well.
Yes.
And then David Christian, he has quite a similar worry to Harari, actually, that he thinks technology might get out of our control. That, as it were, it's funny, there's almost a transference of vitality from what would have been thought of as human, spiritual vitality and imagination, to a rather dead, mechanical, technological vitality that's going to get better because it's faster than human beings. And so we're on a crisis. That crisis we face now is that the AIs are going to overtake us, or that technology has already sort of ruined the planet and will never recover. So they are pretty pessimistic. They don't know where else we can turn to for a sort of source of life that might enable us to see more than just this material technological life, which is sort of consuming us.
But that seems to be because they start out with an atheist worldview, and they obviously end up with one if they start out with one.
I completely agree. I think that's absolutely the point, yeah.
So that, do they actually discuss this initial assumption, or do they just take it for granted that there's no God and it's just a material universe?
They have a sort of hand-wavy first couple of paragraphs saying, religious origins have said this about the cosmos. We don't really know quite where it comes from now, but given that there is one, let's get going.
I see.
Yeah.
But so they just simply filter out the whole world of spirit, religion, God, cosmic purpose, and so on.
Yeah, very much the idea is to tell a story that doesn't rely on that. But the price it pays is that it cuts out not just hope, and as it were, for a different tomorrow, but I think fundamental qualities of the cosmos and certainly human beings and other creatures that are drivers in the development. And this is what my man, as it were, Owen Barfield, that I've written about in my new book, what he was very keen on. He said that if you try and tell these materialist stories, then it's not just that they become pessimistic, but you can't actually really even account for what you see around you too. So for example, this comes up in the way that he understands consciousness having evolved, that myths, Barfield argues, are not just about early attempts to try and explain things, you know, kind of pseudoscience that now we've corrected with modern science. Myths were originally about attempts to try and relate to things. That much as we have kind of rites of passage, stories about romantic love, say, phases that we go through with the birth of children and all that, these kind of narrative structure to our intimate lives now, so too myths were the narrative structures that enable people to relate to the cosmos, to nature, to gods, spirits and entities in the past. So to read them as just failed attempts at science completely misses out that whole side of life, which actually is the side of life that is most immediate and meaningful to us, which is the fact that we relate and that we communicate, you know, that we have narratives, we have a sense of beginning and end that gives shape. So it's not just that they're pessimistic about the future, these are all the materialistic versions, but they actually miss out what's really most important to us. You know, we're not just, much as we might sometimes feel it, we're not just looking forward to the next iteration of the iPhone, exciting though that can be. You know, our everydays are filled up with a whole lot of other stuff that you lose sight of, I think, when you tell these materialist big stories.
Yes. Well, why? I mean, of course, I much prefer the kind of story you tell based on Barfield, with, you know, where there's a meaning, a purpose, and these things fit into a bigger picture. But what do you think is driving this, the sort of Yuval Noah Harari, David Christian, and Fernandez Armesto? Why are they so keen to tell a big story that's, in the end, so pessimistic?
Well, I think another part of it is a sort of arrogance of science. You know, one of the fundamental features of modern science, premises of modern science, is that, well, you correct me on this, but as I understand it, certainly in physics, it's sometimes known as the uniformity principle, that things have been the same always everywhere. So, you know, the Newton's law, second law of motion, sort of works on Earth and it works on a planet on the other side of the cosmos as well. And similarly, throughout history, going back in time and into the future, these laws will remain unchanged. And Barfield said that there's no real reason to assume that. And certainly when it comes to human culture, there's very good reason to assume that humans haven't always experienced the world in the same way. Because, for example, when you read Homer, you're clearly in a very, very different cosmos. You're not in a world where there are pseudoscientists trying to put together. You're in a world where heroes like Agamemnon and Achilles are experiencing deities very immediately. Their sense of what it is to be a person is profoundly different. And Barfield said there's no good reason not to presume that if humans have experienced the universe very differently because they lived in a different universe, then maybe the universe itself is very different across the course of time. It maybe evolves and emerges too. The laws of nature, for example, may well not be fixed. Why would we assume that? It's worked very well for quite a lot of modern science, and it's enabled us to extrapolate these cosmological stories right back to the Big Bang. But, you know, if I was putting money on it, I would reckon that some of the oddities of the big cosmological stories are, like, for example, no one knows what dark matter is, no one knows what dark energy is, that those are the sort of points where there's going to be some sort of crunch and then something new will emerge, say, in, I don't know, maybe I might see it before I die, maybe in 20 years' time. There's inherent weak points that follow out from this uniformity principle that everything's the same everywhere always.
Well, I think that's certainly an assumption built into science. You know, the laws of nature are fixed, the total amount of matter and energy is always the same. in an evolutionary universe, as I've been saying for years, you know, I think that the laws are more like habits. They evolve, they emerge. But the other big change that's happening now in more widespread intellectual movement is the movement towards panpsychism, the recognition of forms of consciousness in nature over and above the human. And panpsychists like Thomas Nagel are not necessarily religious. In fact, he's an atheist. So there are atheist panpsychists who would see consciousness as vastly greater than our own in the universe. Even within astronomy, just a week or two ago, I had a meeting with Greg Matloff, who's an American astronomer, who has what he calls the volitional star hypothesis. He thinks stars are conscious. I do, for other reasons. We've discussed the idea the sun is conscious. But he takes the view that the dark matter interpretation of galaxies, to try and explain the galaxy in terms of adding in all this extra matter to explain what you can't explain just through standard gravity, is completely misguided, because the galaxies are in a sense alive. They're like organisms, and you can no more explain a galaxy in terms of just gravity than you could explain a flock of birds flying together in terms of invoking dark matter holding them together in a flock. You know, it'd be a completely inappropriate way of understanding it. He thinks that astronomy and cosmology themselves are going to have to move to this view of greater forms of consciousness. And if there are greater forms of consciousness in galaxies and stars, then all these attempts to explain human history in terms of a narrow 19th century type materialism of consciousness only in human brains, and then something has just emerged out of blind processes of chance and so on, are going to look very old-fashioned very soon.
Yeah, and I mean, Barfield, I think, pointed to another, he thought it was another revolution that science actually hasn't taken account of yet, really, which was the Kantian revolution associated with Immanuel Kant. Roughly, it goes like this, that modern science assumes that there are primary qualities in the cosmos and secondary qualities. So the primary quantities are things like solidity, you know, which you can measure. They're the kind of empirical factors. They feel like they're objective, they're out there, and science puts them together and as it were, gets going. And then there are secondary qualities like smell, and particularly our senses, colour, that you, as were, don't see out there in the cosmos, but our minds kind of put together and infer. Now, what Kant said is that actually all of our experience, even things like solidity, are only possible because of what our mind puts onto the information that comes into our bodies, as it were, our brains, through our eyes and ears and all the rest of it. So even primary qualities, he argued, have a kind of subjective appeal. This Kant said this, you know, three centuries ago. It seems now to have come about, particularly in quantum theory, which suggests that what you see vis-a-vis solidity very much depends upon the scale at which you're looking. So if you're looking at very, very small quantum scales, there is no solidity. There's probability waves, as I learned when I did my physics degree, something very, very different. And so this kind of Kantian revolution has not really impacted science fully still. And what Barfield says is that actually it's much more natural to think of consciousness as the primary sort of substrate in the cosmos, in this post-Kantian world, and then to wonder how matter ever emerged in it, rather than the standard story now, which is that there's matter and we wonder how consciousness ever emerged.
Yes, and presumably the Barfield story is more optimistic than the inevitably pessimistic stories of these materialist big pictures.
Yeah, so here he draws on spiritual traditions of all sorts, actually. I mean, I, in my book, tell it from the Christian point of view, particularly, but I think there are parallels in other spiritual cosmologies, which is that this movement away from an original consciousness, deity, say, there's a sense of alienation from that. So there is a sense of struggle and suffering, but in that struggle and suffering comes the capacity to form yourself as an individual, as a sense of your own identity. Consciousness itself, you might say, in the individual sense that we experience it, is born in this fall, to use the Christian term, and we, as it were, wake up in this fall. But with that waking up, we can then find consciously our own way back, so that we can share in the fullness of the cosmos once again, but awake, enlightened, fully participating in it. So he argues that this kind of this fall and then rise again is so that we can move towards what he called final participation, which is this idea that, as it were, rather than our deep, deep ancestors that knew but didn't think about it, weren't self-aware of it, we, both in our own lives to some degree, but then a general tendency throughout the history of the cosmos as well, is to return to this spiritual vision, knowingly participating in it.
Well, that's wonderful. I think that not only does your book and this vision give us a better and more inclusive picture, it's also much more hopeful. And also, your book has the advantage of being shorter than these other ones, so I think it's a great achievement.
Thank you very much. I do try to get to the point and, pick up on things like imagination, the qualities of what it is to be human that actually make our lives what they are. Rather than just these sort of rather dead instrumental versions.
Mm.
Anyway, well, we'll to a close there. Maybe one last plug of the book, just to, so people, if people were interested. It's called A Secret History of Christianity, Jesus, the Last Inkling and the Evolution of Consciousness, and is out in August 2019. But thanks very much, Rupert.
Well, thank you, Mark.